This podcast is brought to you by Stella Artois. Make every moment unforgettable with Stella Artois. Whether at home with a cozy dinner or dining out, Stella Artois adds a touch of sophistication to any occasion. Stella Artois, a taste worth more. Enjoy responsibly. Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. On today's show, I'll have a conversation with a couple of people in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. They are the owners of Traveler's Table and the upcoming Traveler's Cart. Let me introduce you all separately so that people can hear your voices. Thea Mitchell, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Yes, I'm Thea Mitchell. And go ahead, Matt.
Matthew Mitchell.
All right. Well, Matthew, let me start with you. I mean, you had, you know, kind of a background in the business world before you opened Traveler's Table. So maybe just talk about that just a little bit, kind of explain your background and how you decided to make this transition to restaurateur.
So I grew up here in Houston, but was fortunate to do a lot of my schooling in Europe. So I had a scholarship to Oxford in England and then studied in France and Italy after that. And then I was a writer and a journalist living in London and Paris and New York, and got to travel the world pretty extensively, which was fantastic, very much on a shoestring, and was probably doing more eating and drinking and enjoying myself than the hard-nosed journalism that I probably should have been doing if I wanted a real career in it. And, you know, was first exposed to this food and felt like even back then somehow it was sort of a gateway to other cultures that somehow sort of understood something about those cultures from eating the food in these back alley street carts and night markets and things. And so I think even back then, and this was in my 20s, just thought, you know, it'd be cool if there was some way to bring all this back and serve it in one venue. And then fast forward multiple years, circle back to that idea after having a career in the pharmaceutical industry and wound up saying, this isn't what I wanted to do with my life. And wound up going to culinary school, cooked in a few places here in town, and went about opening Traveler's Table, which was really about exploring the world through food and drink.
And I actually grew up in restaurants. So my grandmother and mom had a restaurant called Guambeta in downtown Houston when I was growing up. And it was opened in downtown in the 80s and 90s. And then we actually moved to Chinatown after that because they were doing a lot of construction in that area at the time. So a lot of the restaurants started moving out of downtown into Chinatown. So we had that restaurant for a long time. We specialized in a dish called bánh cuốn in Vietnamese, but it's essentially like steam, rice, paper crepe, filled with different types of fillings like pork, shrimp, and then you dip it in fish sauce. But it's a dish that my family, we still cook at home, just because all it takes us back to our days at the restaurant. So my mom actually sold the restaurant when I was in high school, and I thought that was the end of my restaurant days. Like, we were like, at the time, it was a very like family run place. So like the inventory was always off and we'd run out of stuff. My mom would go to the grocery store in the middle of service. It was very chaotic, but there was a lot of love and passion in it, right? And so I grew up in that environment. So when Matt, years later, after we started dating and we were like, obviously we love travel and food, he actually had the idea of like, hey, I think I want to open this restaurant to like bridge everything that we love together. And I was like, okay, let's do it. Like, he was like, I'm going to go to culinary school.
Of course. It's
not I'm going to go to culinary school that I would wonder about. It's the, I'm going to quit my very lucrative job in the pharmaceutical industry to go to culinary school that I feel like could have been a conversation.
Yeah. And her entire family was like, this is a horrible idea.
Yeah. Everyone was like, horrible. This is a horrible idea. I don't think you should do it. Matt and you are living a great life right now. Let's not ruin it. And we were like, you know, let's take the risk because that's something that we wanted to do.
And when they realized that we were committed to this path, I remember all the advice I got was the decor does not matter at all. All that matters is the food. The only reason people go to the restaurant is the food. And so like every, you know, we obviously took a nice space for Traveler's Table and made it our own. But they were very like against spending money on like, you know, a nice lease and being in a, you know, a busy thoroughfare and all that.
And I don't blame them for giving us that advice. Like, you know, on paper, it is a horrible idea. It was a horrible idea.
Well, and serving like a very casual dish like Bankun in Chinatown, the expectations are different, right? Opening in Lower Westheimer and taking a space that had been home to a key and is down the street from Uchi comes with a different set of expectations, right? You have to invest in the design.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of discussed a little bit about kind of the influence of Traveler's Table, but say a little more about that because it's not sort of obvious. Like usually restaurants specialize in one style of cuisine.
Yeah.
And that's not what you do, right? You've taken signature dishes from different international food cultures and put them on a menu together.
Yeah, I'll speak a little bit to that. And there is a little bit of a different philosophy between Traveler's Table, of course, and Traveler's Cart, although they very much share the same DNA. So for Traveler's Table, we call it curated global cuisine. So you know, obviously curate, most people think the museum industry. So we're literally hand selecting dishes, many of which we've had ourselves on our travels. So hand selecting dishes from around the world and in most cases modernizing them. So, you know, we're taking, let's just say our original pad Thai, we you know put soft shell crab on it. That's not necessarily a traditional way to serve it, but soft shell crabs used extensively in Thai cuisine. And so we're really finding these dishes that we can maybe adapt or modernize and give our own spin to, but they are all classic dishes for the most part. And the same thing for the cocktails. So we have a passion fruit mango mojito, you know, usually mojito is just lime and mint, but you know, we do our little twist on it, but it's still based in a classic cocktail or classic dish. Traveler's Cart, in contrast, is a little bit different. It's modern global street food. So same thing, but just at a more, let's just say more accessible price point, not quite as elaborate of dishes, but still trying to sort of expand the globe a little, as best we can with dishes that, for the most part, we've experienced in other cultures.
Right. I mean, just take a half a step back and talk about the motivation to open Traveler's Cart, because, you've been, you know, very successful with Traveler's Table and, you know, in some ways it's sort of tempting to be like, all right, we caught lightning in a bottle. You know, we defied our family's expectations. Here we are.
Yeah.
But you're like, okay, we've got this thing that people really like, let's mix it up. Let's do something a little different.
Yeah. I'll speak to that. I think when we originally opened Traveler's Table, we thought we could potentially open up multiple Traveler's Table, maybe in the Woodlands or in Austin, Dallas. And this was the first time we thought that after we opened, we realized how complex the operations were, right? Even though we got it down, it's a whole lot of work and stress.
A lot of batch recipes.
So
cooking lots of cuisines well. Yeah.
Our kitchen operations is a lot more complex. The training the staff on all the menu items, the cocktails, everything is a little more complex, right? So we were like, oh, this may not be a good concept to replicate multiple times. And actually, when Guy Fieri came to town, he pulled Matt and I aside at the end. He was like, you guys have something really special. You can't open a lot of these around town.
Chef talent,
yeah,
there, you know, front of house talent, like all those things.
It's hard to find chef talent as it is. It's hard to run a restaurant as it is. Everything you're doing is a little bit harder. So he said, you have something really special, but I wouldn't recommend that you open a bunch of these. And it was very genuine advice. He didn't have to say it at the end, but Matt and I started thinking after that, we're like, yeah, he's probably right. Like, I wonder if there's another way to share our passion for food and drink in other ways that, you know, like global street food is something that we're very passionate about because that's something that we love to explore when we're traveling.
And I think that when you're a restaurateur and you're, you know, looking to open up more locations and more restaurants, I think you're kind of faced with this dilemma of, do I stay in my price point and stay in my niche and then open up variations of the same style restaurant? I think that's originally what Chris Shepherd did. I think it's what Hugo and Tracy have done. You know, they have various versions or various variations of a similar price point or and a similar cuisine. I think that it's, you start feeling kind of chainy and maybe even lose some cool if you try to open up multiple locations of a full service, nicer restaurant. I think that very rarely does that end well as far as coming across like a chain. And, you know, that's kind of part of our vibe is to be sort of upscale bohemian or, and so, you know, if there's five Travelers tables in the Houston area, maybe that it loses a little bit of its specialness. And so really we had that, you know, decision of, well, we're going to then go to other cities, which obviously, you know, we did that special with the Gray, you know, out of Savannah, Georgia. You know, that's one of the things they were looking at. Like, do we just start expanding to other cities? But the infrastructure involved with getting, like Doris Metropolitan, shout out to Ty, you know, they've just opened up something in, Austin. Like, that just takes a, you know, another level of getting people and getting resources in other cities, and we'll, you know, be there at some point, but that wasn't what we wanted to do for our second location. So for us, we wanted to really come up with a concept that maybe, you know, I obviously worked for Benji's for a bit, and, you know, they were successful having Benji's, and then, you know, the local foods, we liked that idea of a combination of price points and of style of service. So having, you know, counter service as well as full service.
You know, taking on global street food, I mean, the choices are essentially infinite, right? Like everything from, you know, tacos to burgers to sausage on a stick to, you know, hawker stands to, I mean, it's sort of mind-boggling. So when your choices are essentially infinite, how do you narrow that down to the, I don't know, the 25 or 30 things you're going to serve at Traveler's Cart?
It's quite the process. We try, well, with our Traveler's Table menu, we try to curate it to where like maybe 25% of the menu items are truly like off the beaten path or adventurous to most in Houston. And then 50% are like
middle of the road.
And then I think, you know, the other 25% are familiar and someone like the butter chicken or, you know, the pad thai, you would come in like the gateway food items, right?
Yeah. So I sometimes call them off ramps, right? You know, if you only want a steak or you only want, you know, a roasted chicken or whatever simple sort of thing, you accommodate that pretty well.
Yeah we do. We try to.
I had to have salmon on the menu for my mom, you know, that kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so we took a similar approach with street food for Traveler's Cart. And there's some dishes where we wanted it to feel familiar and comforting. And then there's other items where we felt like, hey, let's do something a little bit more unique. But Matt, do you want to speak on that a little more?
Yeah. So I think that it really, first of all, was how we structured the menu. So we've structured it into sort of six main categories. So we have street snacks, which I kind of fall into the small fried snacky things that you might actually get off of a true street food cart. And next we have is small plates, and that's a little bit more elaborate, you know, things like, you know, shrimp satay and cumin lamb dumplings and things that are maybe a little bit higher price point, but could be shareable. Then we have eat with your hands, which is kind of, you know, burgers and tacos and falafel and fish and chips and things like that. And then market mains, which is what you might think of as more proper plates and bowls, yeah. You know, like beef rendang, you know, peri-peri chicken, pappardelle with brisket ragu, Jamaican jerk pork ribs. So again, you know, then we have get your greens, which is, you know, three nice salads that you can add proteins to. And then you're so sweet, which is our dessert. So the first thing you have to do is let go of what was my trend, which is to be exhaustive in this and realize that you're not going to be able to have something from every food cuisine in the world. there's just some cultures that don't do a ton of street food, you know, and so you just have to let some of that go and realize that you have enough offerings as long as you kind of spread it out the best you can. There's just some cuisines that lend themselves better to street food than others. You know, obviously Southeast Asian, Latin America does, you know, a lot. You know, there's not as many options in Europe, where it tends to be a little bit more of sit down restaurants. But I think we still found some things from each culture that we thought we could do our own little take on, and that fit. And then, of course, you're wanting to mix up the proteins, and then there's just some things you have to have. You have to have dumplings. You're going to have, like you said, some kind of satay or some kind of a kebab. You're going to have, we debated whether or not we're going to enter the burger and taco wars, you know, and so at least we tried to do our own versions of those. So there's some things that, you know, you have to enter the game a little bit, but you know, then some things that I think other people don't have.
All right. So as you said, if you're going to get into tacos, you got to do it right. So tell me, flour or corn tortillas, what kind of fillings, like how did you approach that to do it in a way that like will be appealing to Houstonians who after all eat a lot of tacos, but also is authentic to what you're trying to create?
Yes. I mean, obviously a good portion of our kitchen staff are either Mexican or Guatemalan. And then our executive chef is Puerto Rican and has cooked a lot of Mexican food in his life. So we went corn and wheat flour tortillas. It's a pork carnitas in mole rojo. So it's got a little simmer sauce. So the thing is, it's kind of like barbecue tacos, burgers that for someone who's a true connoisseur, probably like yourself, you can parse out all the little, you know, obviously something's better than something else, but there's a lot of sameness in some of the offerings. So in general, the more familiar a dish, the more we want to do something different so that we're not necessarily trying to go head to head with someone who specializes in tacos, someone who specializes in burgers. So we're trying to do maybe something that's a little bit different that's not as familiar because, you know, we don't specialize in any one cuisine. If it's something that's more off the beaten path, then there's not nearly as many, you know,
components that we have to change or make our own.
Yeah.
Right. And just like you said, with the dumplings, I mean, you know, we all know vegetable dumplings and pork dumplings, and you mentioned you're doing cumin lamb dumplings, which is such a good, like cumin lamb is a very distinctive Sichuan dish, and putting them in a dumpling, I don't think that's not typically how that protein is served. So it's kind of a fresh take on, you know, it's something you can kind of make your own.
And similarly, our samosas. So our crab samosas are our number one selling item.
At Traveler's Table.
I never would have predicted that when I put it on the menu. And so here we're doing a butter chicken samosas. So again, not normal, you know, normally samosas are, but obviously those two components are both, you know, significant parts of Indian cuisine. So we felt like that was a natural fit. And, you know, that's part of what we're wanting to do with Traveler's Cart, you know, being modern global street food is you can be a little bit more playful. There's maybe a little bit more reckless abandon. It's certainly a little bit more edgy. And I do want to qualify that statement by saying, you know, our definition of street food is a little bit maybe more expansive. We're not saying it's truly something that you've gotten off of a food cart. You know, most of the street food markets we've been in around the world, you know, there's the street carts that are actually on the street, and then there's all the little restaurants that line it, and then all the little bars that line, you know, that are around there. So we expand that to being, you know, the dishes you might get in those little restaurants that surround the street food market.
And the atmosphere we want to create would be like, hey, you're walking down like a few blocks in that part of town where they have a lot of the food carts, but there are a lot of really fun restaurants and bars that you may go to afterward, after you eaten at the food market.
Yeah. And I want to also tie in the drinks. So, you know, we also had to be creative with our cocktails because you don't necessarily think of mixed drinks as street food markets, but certainly the bars that surround it. And in a lot of cases, we kind of came up with our own unique twist on cocktails, sometimes incorporating food elements. So we have a Tom Yum Mule. So you have the very much emulating the flavors of Tom Yum soup. We have a De Jerk Chack Punch, which is a Jamaican rum punch with our jerk flavoring from our ribs and our chicken at a Traveler's Table. We have a peach cobbler old fashioned. So things like that, where you're incorporating food items, sort of turning them into drinks when it makes sense. You know, jerk's obviously from Jamaica, so it's rum punch. And so we, you know, being a little bit playful, being a little bit off the cuff, you know, we felt like that was more fitting with street food than maybe you would in a full service restaurant.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, design and obviously Traveler's Table has a a kind of elegance to it. So talk about how do you sort of create that market feel at Traveler's Cart?
Yeah, we worked with Gen Design on our interior designs. Again, we had a really good experience with this last time with Traveler's Table, and we were very happy with it. So with this design, is obviously very different. We wanted it to be more edgy and gritty and casual, but still feel somewhat upscale. And one of the things that we found, especially thinking about our menu and the food items and what we're trying to do, is a lot of people are like, oh, if you want the best, you know, dish in town that serves this, go to this restaurant. And we absolutely encourage people to go to those restaurants and try the food. If you want, you know, maybe you have a group of 10 and someone wants one thing and someone wants another cuisine, we're trying to create an atmosphere where groups can come and then still enjoy the food in a really fun environment with a cocktail component as well. So we have metal grids in there. We have canopies that represents different parts of the world and different carts around the world. We have plastic crates at the...
Well, the grid structure is actually meant to emulate the alleys in a street food market. So when you walk in, it looks like you kind of have two alleys to go through.
Almost like you're walking down an alley with these grids. You'll have to see it, obviously, for yourself. And then for the bar, we actually have our guests walking to our bar to order at two POS stations. So you'll basically see this huge bar that's a centerpiece essentially for the restaurant. And it has signs from all over, street markets from all over the world as well. We've added like travel components like subway stations and other things that may reference travel for the bar as well. So we think it's going to be a really fun place to just come to the bar for drinks and have some snacks or for a meal.
Yeah, I mean, there's one of the things we try to do is have reference points, because again, our brands are really about connecting food and travel and really encouraging people to explore the world through food and drink. And one's at one price point and one level of service, and then Traveler's Cart's at a, you know, more accessible price point at a faster service, but in more expansive hours. So we're even going to be open late night for Traveler's Cart. But again, we are trying to create an environment where people want to come for multiple occasions. So maybe quick lunch, but also maybe a place you come for dinner or come with friends, stay late. And so, you know, in addition to this kind of bar canopy, tease time out in the grid structure, the bathroom vestibules coated in foreign currency. So we call that our currency tunnel. We have a collage of different maps and travel posters. And then we have a really inviting patio with...
Oh, yeah. There's 80 seats out there. So it fits a lot of people. And then we have string lights. And we have this like stadium seating to reference like, okay, in other cities, sometimes you get some food and there's nowhere to sit, right? So the stadium seating is actually a nice place where you can just grab a handheld and have like, you know, a bite on the stair steps.
Like you're sitting on the shopkeeper steps or the church steps in Rome or whatever with eating your you know, sandwich or what have you. So... So lots of different reference points. Hopefully most, you know, try not to necessarily be too on the nose with any of them. But, you know, I think that's ultimately what we're trying to do is create almost a hybrid between full service and fast casual. And what I mean by that is, you know, it's a price point where it's very much in keeping with takeout and to-go and delivery and all that, because we don't have a ton of that in at Traveler's Table price point. But then it's nice stuff as far as the ambiance where you would want to come and spend time. And it's not just a place to come and get a quick lunch and get in and out. And then having a full liquor program with some inventive cocktails. You know, hopefully people want to stay a while.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing where, you know, finding that service component, you know, we talked about on the show last week with Chop and Block, which is also Gin Designs, also fast casual, also trying to sell people cocktails. And of course it's located basically across the street from Traveler's Table, but you know, people don't necessarily want to go back to the counter to order that second cocktail. So, you know, that kind of Loro or Hop Dottie or whatever, you know, model where they'll, you know, either if it's a QR code or people who kind of work the floor or whatever, but where they'll come to you and take that order for the second drink or the extra dessert or the whatever. Like I do think that's helpful if you're trying to create that slightly more elevated dinner environment.
Yeah, we'll have the QR codes. We'll have team members walking around helping put in second orders as well. We absolutely don't want anyone to get in line again to have to get that second drink or the dessert. So we're actually thinking through ways to be more efficient with operations, with reorders, and if someone wants to add on food.
So, you know, obviously, when is the big question, right? We all drive down Montrose Boulevard. We see you working on it. So approximately when do you think we'll be eating a traveler's cart?
So we're working on our mock services right now. And those will sort of be probably this weekend, early next week. And so we're thinking about probably the last week or, you know, last week of October. So we're getting real close.
Yeah, we're just trying to make sure the team, we're ready to serve. And we're doing the mock services with friends and family to get all our mistakes in with them, hopefully. And then when we feel like we're ready, the goal is to definitely open by the end of the month.
Yeah, we don't want to set too hard of an opening date because I don't know if you remember from when we opened Traveler's Table, but our mock services did not go as well as we'd hoped. And so it's nice to have a few days to kind of reboot if you need to. And this way, again, we've done this now before, so we're a little bit more experienced this go around. But you want to make sure you have time to actually correct the things that are identified during the mock services. You know, that's the whole point of having them in the first place. But definitely opening in October.
Well, and of course, you know, you kind of flew in under the radar a little bit with Traveler's Table. I don't think people quite knew what to make of you, but you know, as I said before, I mean, you've become a real staple in Montrose, and I think people are going to be really excited about this. I think they're going to want to check it out, and they're going to be, you know, expecting a Traveler's Table style experience.
Yeah, I mean, you asked why we did this, and I guess circling back to that question, it's ultimately that we felt like this was not that we want to become some national huge brand or something, but we did feel like we could open up more. You know, there's all kinds of data saying that people won't drive more than 3 to 5 miles for a counter service where, you know, we have people driving in from the Woodlands and, you know, outer Katy, you know, to Traveler's Table. So we want to be able to come to our guests a little bit more easily with Traveler's Cart than making them drive all the way to Traveler's Table. So, you know, we'll hopefully open up a handful of these in Houston and bring it to different neighborhoods. And we think it's a little bit more expandable but still very much the same DNA of this, you know, exploring the world through food and drink.
I mean, I know that it's tricky before the first one is even open, but do you have a timeline in mind for, you know, getting the next one or two up and running?
Well, our goal is after we get settled down, we're going to start looking at real estate. It does take, as you know, a really long time to potentially look for a spot, negotiate a contract. But we'll actually start looking at real estate probably a few months after we open.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we want to prove the model again. And we always forget about how hard it is to create a brand from scratch, which is part of the fun part and also very daunting at the same time. So the good news is, you know, as I'm sure you can relate, once you have all those decisions from everything from the logo to the colors to everything and most of the design elements and the menu, then doing the second one and the third one, you know, the economies of scale make it easier. So I think we probably won't do a full build out the next time around, but we were really passionate about planning, just like with Traveler's Table, trying to plan a, you know, sort of a flag to say this is what the brand is. And then having lots of parking was key. We have over 66 parking spots, which is huge inside the Loop. And Traveler's Table wasn't blessed with that many parking spots. So we wanted, especially for a counter service, to not have that same hurdle.
Yeah, your valets are very good at playing Tetris with all the people that come to visit the restaurant.
But yeah, and we have three lots there. We rent an additional three lots in addition to what we have at the restaurant.
So hopefully we won't have to deal with that this time around, which is why we were so enthusiastic about this space. And we love Montrose and, you know, we live nearby and all those things. So,
yeah. You know, the one other thing is you sort of mentioned that you had that conversation with Guy Fieri, and, you know, I don't know how much we've talked about your time on the show. Cause it, you know, he comes in and you're not allowed to say anything and then it airs. And so just what was the effect of being on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives for you? I mean, what was that experience like?
So I'll say, first off, it happened in the middle of COVID. So it wasn't just that we were trying to not, you know, keep it a secret or anything. It was also just, you know, there was like a hush over the whole industry. As you know, they set up a COVID testing van in the parking lots. Everybody that came and went had to get tested. I don't think people realize what an incredibly detailed process it is. It's like, you know, it's practically a whole week. You know, he has a team of like 10 guys. You're having to cook all these recipes. You know, you basically have to cook the dishes in multiple stages so that, you know, obviously the episode is so brief that you don't have time to actually fully cook the dish. So it's like the raw form. Okay, let's see it at the 1/16th cooked. You know, okay, let's do the 1/8. Okay, let's do the 1/4, you know, so that it looks like it's a time lapse. You know, it was very much like a film shoot as far as the level of complexity. You know, Guy, you know, obviously he has his own persona with the Camaro and the hair and everything, but could not have been more gracious. You know, I think one of the things you do fantastic that really Guy does as well is they're real champions for the industry. You know, there's some critics and some people that aren't, you know, that you don't feel that way about. And so he was very complimentary. You know, obviously we love the finished product. But it was a little bit the same thing as, you know, where our chef Stanton Bundy beat Bobby Flay. It was kind of like it happens. And then the airing date is so long after it happens that you've kind of almost forgotten. I mean, you've waited so long and it's very much a delayed gratification kind of thing.
One of the interesting things is, I mean, we filmed that in 2021. So it's been a few years already, but we'll still get new customers from that show because they do the reruns every few months. And so we'll get people that mention that show every time, like every few months when I think it's like pretty much after a rerun, we'll get like a different flood of people coming in.
Well, and a lot of times it's people traveling to Houston. So like people Google, like we
went, right, they look up all the places he's been.
Yeah. Exactly. Guy, and yeah. Then you'll yeah. come to the Houston restaurants that Guy went to.
Yeah.
Right. And of course you are neither a diner, a drive-in, nor a dive. So, but he likes, he does the occasional, like slightly more fine dining spot.
You know, we honestly thought it was a prank when we got called. We were like, there's no way the food.
Well, it was very short notice. Yeah. So apparently he wasn't even planning on mentioning Houston when he came. He was here to cook a private dinner for Lee Majors, the Fall Guy.
Yes. The $6 million. No, the $6 million man. Right.
Yeah. But he was also the Fall Guy.
Also the Fall Guy. Yeah.
And so he's like, let's just shoot some, you know, and I know he did the Pit Room and I think Toasted Coconut and right. Weights and Measures and a handful of
places. Yeah, be more Pacific, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But it was, that was actually a different time, but it was very, they contact us very close to, and so I think it really did put a lot of pressure on us to get them all the information. And then what's interesting about both that and the Bobby Flay experience was their input on what dishes they want. I mean, like we literally went through every item on the menu and, you know, coming down to what, you know, Guy Fieri doesn't eat eggs and, you know, Bobby Flay, oh no, we that dish is too chefy and they can't make that at home or we've already done something like that. So it was almost like a triangulation of all these different factors that get you to the dishes that you cook.
Yeah, right. Like I remember when Bobby Flay went head to head with Kevin Adairy, right? And they did cabbage rolls, which is not a dish that I think has ever been on the menu at Roost. But you know, in the conversation of, well, Kevin's Persian and he wants to do something that's kind of Persian-y, but you know, it's got to be something that Bobby has a reasonable shot at making. It's, you know, it's like the behind the scenes of like how you get to the dish that you get to, right? And of course, you guys did the duck carnitas. That's
Duck chiliculus. And getting there was, I mean, it was literally like our 20th suggestion because what we realized that was that what they wanted was a dish that home cooks could make and was literally something you could Google. They didn't want something like created out of thin air, you know, something too chef driven. So they wanted something that you could Google, like, you know, Eggs Benedict or something, but they wanted us to have our own spin on it, right? And so literally they just told us, look, just do the chiliculus. And so Stanton got there and they're like, that was a really bold choice of you to pick one of Bobby's original dishes from his opening cookbook. And chef's like, what? So it's like, not only is this not my signature dish, it's Bobby's signature dish. Yeah. So it was a funny experience. But, you know, he obviously won, so that's all.
Right. And they had a good time kind of playing him up as the Texas cowboy, right? The hunter and the rancher. I think, you know, to his credit, your chef, Stanford Bundy, had a really good time kind of leaning in all that. And as you said, he won. So that's the most important thing.
But yeah, those have been good experiences, and, you know, the good exposure and those people you wind up finding, Bobby as well, just a lot more humble and gracious than necessarily their TV persona.
All right. Well, I have to say that does bring me to the end of my questions. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you would like to discuss?
Yeah. So I'm not going to go through it now, but we have a entry plaque when you come to the restaurant, just like at Traveler's Table. We have a part on the menu that kind of explains Traveler's Table. It's like a letter from me and T. There's also this plaque. It's also on the menu, you know, about welcome to Traveler's Cart. And it really pays tribute. And it's really what a lot of the basis of this concept is paying tribute. Her grandmother sold bánh cuốn on the streets in Vietnam before immigrating to the U.S. and opening her restaurant. And really, we do want to express how when we travel these other parts of the world, how humbling it is to see the people cooking this food. And we really want to pay tribute to that. It's not really, we've obviously loved that, but it's incredibly, I'll just use the word humbling, to see. And we really want to pass those food traditions on. So we really try to do our best to be, I guess, true to that nature of those dishes and that experience.
Well, and you know, I think having it grounded in your travels and your appreciation for these places, you avoid that trap that some people fall into of, oh, we want to elevate, you know, we want to, you know, that word has become so loaded and so problematic. And you're coming from a place of appreciation and paying homage to these dishes. And I think that's a good, I think that's one of the reasons the restaurant has been so successful is it respects all of these places that you're referencing and gives people a version that is, you know, delicious, frankly.
Yeah. And hopefully whether or not you've been to these other places and enjoyed those dishes like us, or you haven't, and you want to try them and you know, don't get the chance to leave Houston that much. Like either way, like we hope we're able to present all these dishes in, you know, an appealing environment. And the dishes, like you said, are hopefully delicious. So yeah, that's really what we're trying to do.
All right. Well, that is a good place to wrap this up. But before I let you go, we have to play the lightning round. 5 easy questions, 5 short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. T, let me start with you. Okay. What is your favorite ingredient?
Sesame oil.
Matthew, how about you?
Coconut curry.
Matthew, what is
really,
the...
That's not really an ingredient, but I...
Yeah, close enough. Matthew, what is the first band you ever saw in concert?
Pearl Jam.
T, how about you?
I don't even remember. Sorry, I'll have to skip.
Spice Girls.
Spice Girls. I don't know.
All right. This is the one. Remember that this show also airs on a sports talk radio station. So my one nod to sports is T. Who is your favorite Houston sports figure, past or present?
Oh, I mean, I'll just say Simone Biles because I watched her throughout the Olympics.
Simone Biles is a great answer. Matthew, how about you?
The Dream, baby. Olajuwon.
Can't go wrong with Akeem. Matthew, what is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
Uh-huh. I've actually been eating a fair amount of Trill Burger right now.
They have a drive-thru. That works for me. T, how about you?
I like to go through the drive-thru at my friend's at Saigon Hustle. They have these salmon spring rolls that I love, and they're quick and healthy and easy to eat. Love them.
All right. And then finally, I know you guys get out some, but what is the new Houston restaurant you haven't been to yet that you are dying to try?
Octo.
Yeah.
Oh, I want, Eric, maybe you can help me with the name. I want to try Neo's new place.
Oh, Kira. Yeah,
I've been wanting really to good. Go there. I called 3 times and like, because we always do things last minute because we're so busy. And so we never know when we're available. And so I'll have to call restaurants usually like an hour before, and they've been booked the last few times, unfortunately.
And T mentioned her family's background in the restaurants, but T worked at sushi restaurants her entire 20s, it seemed like. So all of her friends in Houston, including all the ones who own restaurants, we're all date back to those restaurants. So she's a big sushi girl.
Very good. All right. Well, give us the website and the social media for Traveler's Table and Traveler's Cart.
Traveler's Table, travelerstable.com, travelerscart.com, and Traveler's Table Restaurant is the Instagram handle. And then Traveler's Cart Restaurant is the Instagram handle for our new restaurant.
Matt and T, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Always a pleasure, buddy.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.